Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, joined by, this is an all-staff podcast, Jim Swift in Washington, D.C., Andrew Egger from Noah's Ark?
I'm in Michigan right now, Charlie.
You're making your way back.
Pretty close to you, I think. Yeah.
if I look out from my house, I can actually see Michigan from my house.
Is that, yeah, well.
That's no, that's good. Not true, actually. that's completely not true. So I have to mention, you guys realize that yesterday was the six-month anniversary of the launch of the Bulwark. We are officially 6 months and one day old. It seems a lot longer, doesn't it?
Well, how far we've come, Charlie. I mean, we launched and the country was, you know, languishing under the sort of craziness of the Trump era and all these things that were going on, and now look around and
things are fixed. I guess.
Hey, time is a flat circle, boys.
Yeah, right.
A quick reminder to anyone who's listening to our podcast: you can subscribe to us on Apple, on through iTunes, through Google Play, Stitcher, any place where podcasts are available. I started off my newsletter this morning, gentlemen, with just sort of a palate cleanser to get started with the week after the long weekend. This tweet from McKay Coppins from The Atlantic. Would it be too much? He's quoting from an op-ed piece written by Miriam Adelson, who is the wife of Sheldon Adelson, and the recent recipient of the Freedom Medal or whatever from...
Presidential
Medal of Freedom. She writes an op-ed in the paper that she and her husband own. Would it be too much to pray for a day when the Bible gets a, quote, book of Trump, much like it has a book of Esther, celebrating the deliverance of the Jews from ancient Persia? Now, my take is, yes, that would be too much to ask, but who knows? Obviously, we're out of touch with things these days. But a whole book in the Bible, it's not enough that he be, God King. He has to have his own book in the Bible.
I'm sure we can get Jerry Falwell Jr. and some of these other evangelical sellouts on that to add another fake book.
Okay, well, that's the question, though, because, I mean, those would be the sorts of people who, you know, you'd need your Blue Ribbon Committee to sort of, like, get it printed and things. But I don't think Falwell Jr. or anybody in his circles has sort of the manic prophet type energy that you'd need to actually, you know, write the thing. So that's my big question is who are some likely authors, seen by many today as, you know, cranks and maniacs, but who actually just are sort of, you know, flowing with the spirit more, a little more strongly than the rest of us. Who would that be?
Doesn't President Trump have his own, like, personal pastor? You know, that woman, you know, who runs one of those crazy churches. I'd say that would be a great author right there. I mean, there, you know, I think the sad part about all of this is there are always going to be cranks that think, you know, Obama is the second coming of Christ, George W. Bush or Trump. I mean, you're always going to have these loons. This is America. There are hundreds of millions of us. But there's no shortage right now of semi-prominent religious leaders who actually could try and make this happen. I mean, a billionaire's kooky wife. Yeah, there are at least a couple dozen of them.
If we stay on the trajectory we're on now, it'll be Hugh Hewitt will write it. I mean, that's just it would be that. We'll get to Ari Fleischer. Speaking of the Bible, speaking of biblical magnitude. So, Jim, you're in D.C. I'm just watching the videos of the flooding and the raining going on in D.C. And normally I'm tempted, those of us in the Midwest are tempted to, you know, maybe, you know, casually suggest that you folks in D.C. are a little bit wimpy when it comes to weather. But I mean,
Absolutely,
my God. No. This is like, what did you describe it as? It's like a hurricane except for the wind, which I thought was, I don't know, Jim, usually the hurricane is the wind, but. What's going on? I mean, it is like a tsunami, right?
Whenever there's any precipitation, whether it's rain or snow, you got to add 25, 30 minutes to your commute because people around here can't drive. And the contention that locals are wimps is absolutely correct. Someone from Ohio and someone who's used to actual real snow, not like you St. Louisans who are like, oh, it's the ice, you know, but the humidity. Here, whenever it rains in any significant amount, and this was like a slow storm with no real winds. I mean, we've had storms all week, but it just was a torrential downpour. You know, it's sort of like when literally an inch of rain comes to Arizona, like they just can't handle it because they haven't designed Arizona to handle a ton of rain. DC's the same way. So when my bus came into the Pentagon today, there was literally a foot and a half of water. And, you know, you see other places and they were actually rescuing people on gondolas.
I know. I saw this. It was crazy. I mean, people who had to get out of their cars and swim. So this was...
This is why we have insurance, Charlie. Hopefully nobody died. It's probably unlikely that anybody did. Say a prayer that nobody did. But this is why you have car insurance. Is it an inconvenience?
It stinks. It's pretty stoic. Kind of a stoic guy today. So let's talk about the great moments in presidential rhetoric. We are way late on this, but there are some moments that you just know are going to live in history. The president's Trump of July speech, which has already been turned into a political ad, which I think is kind of interesting. But the line that I think people will remember, and I don't think this is a cheap shot, although it may be, is this one.
A valley forge found glory across the waters of the Delaware and seized victory from Cornwallis of Yorktown. Our army manned the airport. It ran the ramparts. It took over the airports. It did everything it had to do. And at Fort McHenry, under the rocket's red glare, it had nothing but victory.
Okay, gentlemen, let's just break this down. I mean, apparently there was a teleprompter glitch, so the president was forced to freestyle the Battle of Fort McHenry, which apparently he sort of vaguely remembered it had something in the air and something ramparts.
So it was Fort McHenry, right?
Okay. I mean, this weird word salad, kind of like just random noises, you know, that, you know, involved hashtag winning. But my favorite part was is the usual suspects come forward to declare this the greatest speech ever. Ari Fleischer, who really must despise the Bushes because he's just all in on Trump. This is the greatest speech the president has ever given.
Truly, that's the day he became president. You know, yeah. two years in, his like second inauguration try. I mean, he got the crowds he wanted because then he knew the crowds would be there and he'd harness them, right? But our pal Stu Stevens had a really interesting tweet about when he worked for George W. Bush about it's like members of Congress aren't allowed to use floor speeches, right? Or C-SPAN clips in their campaign ads, right? So or even candidates too. The White House typically in the past has been very, very careful about using White House footage because you're not supposed to use it. So I don't know if Stu was intimating that the taxpayers clearly paid for all of this. He was intimating that the taxpayers might have paid for the video. I don't know if that's the case. But one thing is certain, this was basically a campaign ad funded by taxpayers.
Okay, but now you say that this is something they're not supposed to do. And Stu Stevens said, "Babe, back in 2004, we would never have done this because this would have been wrong." But is it wrong as in there's actual laws against it, or is it wrong because there are norms which we now find out are just sort of flimsy suggestion guidelines, waves by cucks? I mean, what?
Well, in the case of Congress, there are each body gets to set its own rules. And I know that there are, in these rules basically have the same full force and effect of as laws as it pertains to their members and their employees. One body can't tell the other what to do per se.
Okay. All right. So
the White House, I personally off the top of my head don't know, you know, whether it's a, I mean, look at the Hatch Act, right? Even if it is a law, I don't think the White House would give a
okay.
Because so who's going to do something about
it?
Right?
You didn't go to the Trump of July? Mr.
No.
Swift?
No,
okay.
No, it was going to rain. I've got kids who have the time of 7 o'clock. That's dumb.
But we sent Molly Jong Fast, who has a great, great piece describing what it's like, what it was like. People ought to check that out on The Bulwark that she actually went.
I cannot get enough of Molly Jong Fast's piece on this. It's really, really, really good.
I just love this one where she said, you know, that it was supposed to be modeled on France's Bastille Day, but it turned out to be more heartbreaking than festive. It was a muddy metaphor for an empty lot of a presidency. But I thought the moment where he went, "Ooh, this is really, really good," where she has this sort of epiphany where, you know, she's seen these QAnon flags and these various other people, and she suddenly realizes it's sort of like some weird time warp. But the America, the real strangeness is the America's from two different timelines colliding in one space, like those sci-fi movies where a group of Marines from World War II find themselves pulled through a wormhole into ancient Rome.
Yeah,
we had the apolitical America from 3 years ago, who came to Washington to watch fireworks and eat fried food and show their kids the monuments, and they were bumping up against the people from the new America, which now views the 4th of July as another battle in the Trump wars, a chance to own the libs or hashtag resist or get internet famous.
Charlie, you know what's weird is those QAnon people didn't seem to make it into the RNC's ad. Must have been a strange coincidence.
Okay, but before we get too deep into this, so is there a movie where a group of Marines from World War II show up in ancient Rome? Because I want to see that movie.
That's an internet meme. That's a Reddit meme of, you know, would a battalion of Marines been able to use, like, if you just had a time machine. And then my father-in-law a couple years ago showed me an old movie where, like, a World War II aircraft carrier just, like, went through.
I know. I love that movie. So if Spartacus had a Piper Cub, how would history have changed?
Or, you know, if the British had an Air Force, right, you know, during the Revolutionary War.
This is why The Man in the High Castle is awesome.
Oh, I can't wait for the next season, man.
Yeah, if you should have seen this. Okay, so before
we get off of this, I do want to say one other thing about Molly's piece, and not to toot my own horn, but I wrote a piece for us a couple of months back, specifically just sort of talking about Twitter and sort of the way we all are to each other online, and this sort of nice thing that we tell ourselves, which is that, well, like, the person you are online isn't really like the real you. That's just sort of, you know, people are meaner to each other, but like in real life, we're all still kind of friendly people. But the thing that I was talking about in that piece is sort of like the more and more of our lives we sort of transact online, and the more and more of our relationships and just sort of our interactions with the world are mediated through that, the more and more those sorts of, the sort of online modes of being tend to sort of spill over into the actual sort of physical meat space world where we all live. And that's one of the things I found so fascinating about Molly's piece, and just about this fourth thing in general, is like, it's this event was like an internet squabble taking place, like, in real time, in real space on the Mall, with Proud Boys and resistors and all of these, you know, big blown up posters and statues and things. It's just like, it's just memes bouncing off one another. And
or the majority of the people at the July 4th were normal.
But yeah, no, absolutely. But
6 years ago, QAnon wasn't there. The Proud Boys weren't there. You didn't have any of this, right? And this was, I think, a point that Molly made in her piece. I mean, you go back to the Covington sort of thing. Like, I worked for George Bush's campaign in 2004, and I've been to a dozen of the marches for life. People weren't really wearing George Bush hats, you know, in the mid-aughts. I mean, the politicization of everything.
It's new. It's new. Okay, Andrew, I think, was getting at another sci-fi meme. So you're basically saying that we, in fact, are the jerks that we are on Twitter. So that when I tweet something tasteless out and somebody says, Charlie, you're better than that, and I respond, no, I'm not, obviously. No, I'm not better than that. This is who I am. I'm tweeting it out. So, you know, reversing the sci-fi image from Molly's story, Andrew, it's sort of like we've all now gone into the simulation. We've been playing this video game of politics, and suddenly we're all in it.
Right.
Yes. It's like we wake up one day and we're in our Twitter timeline. And we are stuck there forever. There's like a Twilight Zone like that, isn't there?
Yeah, well, that's you guys are so down on our favorite Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, but that's, you know, that's his whole thing. The internet's killing us, it's poisoning us, we better do something about it. Maybe his solutions are terrible, but I admire that he's he's out there.
Tron. If we're going with sci-fi references, Charlie, we are all in Tron. We have all logged into the game.
Oh, man.
It's a little before your time, Andrew.
Do you remember that? I'll go before your time. I'll one up you. The Twilight Zone, one of the most haunting Twilight Zone. This guy keeps going into this, goes into the this art museum, and he sees a boat on a lake, and he really wishes himself into this boat on a lake. And it turns out that he's a Nazi war criminal, and he's being chased. And he just wants more than anything else to go back into this museum and get into the picture. And so that's all he wants. He wants to get into the picture, which he thinks is going to be the picture of the boat on this lake. But apparently they've changed the pictures. So he, you know, wills as strong as he can, put me back in the picture. And he's like on this crucifix for all eternity. Man. So
that's some Man in the High Castle, you know, Ava Perón sort of stuff.
Okay, so apparently we're going to talk with Tim Alberta, whose awesome new book is out next week. I'm actually reading it. I got an advanced copy. And he has an interview with Donald Trump, where Donald Trump compares AOC to Eva Perón. And there's a lot of skepticism about this, that how would Donald Trump have ever heard of Eva Perón? But it's historical.
Probably from the television.
No,
Don't Cry for Me.
Yeah, that's about the only thing. So we will see that. All right, so let's should we talk about something actually serious here? Justin Amash, big splash over the weekend, declares his independence, has an op-ed piece in the Washington Post saying he is out. The two-party system is toxic to our democracy, and appears on CNN yesterday, leaving the door open, it seems, to a possible independent/libertarian bid for 2020. So give me your quick 30,000-foot hot take on this, Andrew Egger.
I mean, surely he's running for president, right? I mean, that's the there doesn't seem to be any other very concrete takeaway from this. I mean, it's a largely symbolic move that sort of makes sense given a lot of the moves Amash has been making for a while. Obviously, he's been incredibly critical of President Trump. He stepped down from the Freedom Caucus, which he himself founded back in the day. So he's been making all of these moves. And has, you know, this is not the first time either that he has sort of been a little cute about whether or not he's going to run for president. But I do think this is as concrete a step as he's taken in that direction. I mean, I think there's something, Jim, maybe you remember about this. There's something about Michigan's election law that means where if he runs in a certain primary and loses, he's then not able to run in a race following that. So I think it might have something to do with the fact
a lot of states have sore loser laws.
Right.
But, you know, I'm not sure if I agree with you as to whether or not he's running for president. But
if he is,
if he is, it reminds me of the old joke. What did the kamikaze instructor say to his students? Watch closely. I'm only going to do this once. he might be running for re-election, and he already has a primary challenger if he were to remain Republican, who I think was polling close to him. And I think Donald Trump Jr. was probably not incorrect in saying he'd probably lose that primary. But you saw, like, Lisa Murkowski. It can happen. And I think that a lot of his actions have won over a lot of Democrats who probably, if it was him versus a woke Democrat, would vote for the woke Democrat. But knowing, you know, what Grand Rapids is like, they might just say, you know, screw it and vote for Amash as a third party candidate. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've talked about this on the podcast, and this is an oft repeated refrain, is you can only police your party from within. Right. Otherwise, it's not effective. And we've seen this. Charlie has, as you know, and Bill has, and other, you know, kind of more popular figureheads than Andrew Egger or Jim Swift, no offense, why would we listen to Never Trump Republicans, right? And that sort of proves the point. Liberals aren't going to listen to us when it comes to us giving them advice. And I think Amash knows this. And I think that is a huge consequence. I mean, he's always been kind of more on the libertarian side of things. He hasn't been a social warrior like some of the more social conservative members of the Republican Party. But him choosing to just opt out and being a Pied Piper, maybe that goes to your point, Andrew. Maybe he is running. And
he'll be a good fit for the libertarians. He doesn't have to, let's face it, you know, Bill Weld was not a great fit for the libertarians.
Right.
Justin Amash will be like seamless. And okay, so here's, okay, let's move on. I mean, the biggest question, obviously, is does this help or hurt Trump? And we're going to have this debate right now. And the question is, what are the consequences for Michigan, which of course is going to be absolutely huge. I heard one analysis this morning that said, you know, if Trump wins Florida and North Carolina, he only needs to win one of the upper Midwest states. And I think he can do that. I really do think he can do that. But you take Michigan off the board and that becomes a little bit more complicated. So I don't know. I mean, the conventional wisdom has been a third party candidate helps Trump in this particular case because Amash is so conservative. it seems much more likely that he would draw from the Republicans. Agree? Disagree?
Right.
Agree.
Well, I think the moral there is, I mean, you can't extrapolate about what, you know, a median third party candidate would do, because every third party candidate is running on a different platform. I mean, back when it was Howard Schultz, who was looking like the guy who was going to get in, I mean, nobody was ever going to vote for Howard Schultz. But the danger that some people on the left saw was that, well, he might try to pull off some centrist Democrats if the actual nominee ends up too far to the left. I mean, that could end up helping Trump. Obviously, there were not going to be a lot of Republicans voting for the Starbucks CEO. Starbucks is one of those brands that has, you know, entered the sort of conservative cultural consciousness as an enemy. So that was sort of a non-starter in terms of peeling off Trump voters. Obviously, Amash is sort of the opposite proposition where you never know. I mean, obviously, hindsight's 2020. It seems as though he's a much more compelling potential candidate than like Evan McMullen, for instance, who really the only reason why you would vote for Evan McMullen for president is sort of as a protest vote yeah. against Trump. That's not really the case with Amash. I mean, Amash is more conservative than Trump on many, many, many issues. He's, you know, obviously has legislative experience and has a really good head on his shoulders and everything. I mean, Amash is the kind of guy who
bona fides. It's not transactional.
Yeah. He's the kind of guy you could vote for because you would actually like to see him be president and be like happy about that. But the possibility is obviously there for him to peel votes off from Trump. I would sort of need to see it to believe it. Right. Cause I mean, a lot of people are, even many people, I think, who would prefer to have Amash be president to Trump are just never going to vote for a third party candidate. That's just sort of the calculation they've made for themselves. So I have no idea how to game all that out, really. But
you know what would be one of the most ironic parts about an Amash libertarian run is if he was so successful, he got the Libertarian Party enough votes to get federal financing. Oh, what would they do? my principles.
What would they do?
Oh, they'd take the money, right? I mean, come on.
that would be interesting, though.
Yeah. I mean,
that would be an interesting moment. Okay, so should we talk about Jeffrey Epstein?
Oh,
yeah.
Lord.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got
should,
to,
should
right?
we debate whether it's Jeffrey Epstein or Jeffrey Epstein? Should we get this out of the way?
We got to call our old colleague Ethan.
Okay.
You know, Ethan on the Epstein. Yeah.
So what is fascinating is that this is the Rorschach test, where, you know, if you're on the right, you go, yeah, this is Bill Clinton's BFF. You're on the left, you go, this is Donald Trump's BFF. I mean, this guy got around. I mean, this is an amazing story.
And
this,
if you're part of QAnon, it's just like, yes, it's all coming true.
I don't even want to get my head around what
that is.
Okay,
we don't have to talk about that. So, but I mean, everybody has an angle with this.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, so he's been arrested and charged with sex trafficking by federal prosecutors. I mean, which is really amazing because he had beaten the rap. He'd gotten an amazing deal that nobody really fully understood.
By one of Trump's cabinet members.
Yes, Acosta.
In the state of Florida, is that right? Where the charges were? Yeah.
And the Miami Herald just kept dogging it and dogging it and dogging it and dogging it. And so this is brought back, and the charges are being brought by the Southern District of New York, and they've assigned it to their public corruption unit, or public integrity unit, whatever they call it, which is also interesting. And of course, there's, you know, people are floating around this quote from 2002 from Donald Trump. I've known Jeff for 15 years. Terrific guy. He's a lot of fun to be with. It's even said that he likes beautiful women as much as I do, and many of them on the younger side. Jeffrey enjoys his social life.
And you know who's in charge of the case, Charlie,
Every freaking word of that quote is bad.
Just sends chills down your spine.
The person in charge of the case is Jim Comey's daughter.
Lord.
It is, and Lordy, maybe there are tapes. You just never know.
Well, you know, back when I was at the Weekly Standard.
It could be tapes. So,
we got anonymous tips about this stuff from Never Trump types and his connections to Epstein. And I looked into them. I spent a considerable amount of time.
I was told to.
We were not the New York Times. We were not the Wall Street Journal. We did not. I mean, it was literally just me. And I couldn't get anything so tangible that like justified looking into it further. But clearly, like, the stuff with Epstein clearly stunk. You know, his deal, it stunk. All of this stunk. And Trump was clearly friends with him, just as Clinton was, and then I think Alan Dershowitz. And that's why I said, like, everybody gets a bite of this apple. And I think I saw someone on Twitter say, if you think that he's going to give up just your political opponents, don't be naive. And I think that this has a possibility to really dominate the news cycle.
It could because there's so much to it. And by the way, there is the story in the Miami Herald, a court to unseal up to 2,000 pages of Jeffrey Epstein-related documents. It was a federal appeals court last Wednesday ordered the unsealing of all of those judicial documents that are expected to show evidence relating to, you know, whether Epstein and his partner were recruiting underage girls. Now, maybe nothing matters here, but there's something about this particular story that seems like it's going to be difficult to emerge unscathed, including, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves here, but Alan Dershowitz, can you imagine Alan Dershowitz, you know, that his reputation is going to take a battering on this. I mean, he's been very forward. He actually wrote
not that it hasn't
letter.
Already.
Well, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean there's a difference between writing bad op-eds and being tied up in something like this, right? I mean, holy.
Right.
Absolutely. And also, I mean, he wrote an open letter to the Pulitzer Committee saying, don't give the Miami Herald a Pulitzer Prize for all of this. So he is mm-hmm. he is deep into all of this stuff. You know,
yeah.
I don't know.
The thing.
So where does it go?
The thing that's so fascinating to me about this story is it's all coming out and it's immediately being sorted into like all the same sort of like predictable, like how does this figure into our, you know, sort of bilateral partisan war, right? Is it going to be more Republicans who go down? Is it going to be more Democrats who go down? And that's sort of the way a lot of people are taking it. But what's so interesting about the story is the way that the actual sort of facts of what appeared to happen sort of transcends all of that, right? I mean, it's more the flavor of like, you know, what before Trump sort of like went all in as like a Republican guy and the Republican establishment rallied around him and stuff. It's more that sort of energy. It's the sort of thing he was talking about when he first jumped in. He's just like, it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican, the whole thing's rigged. If you've got money and power and influence, you know, you can get away with anything. You can get away with murder. I mean, and all these people are doing all this stuff. He knew Epstein, so there's something to that. But it's just it really is sort of a window into this sort of world that we just don't really talk or think about all that much in terms because we're such partisan squabblers. But it's you know, up at the very top, the Democrats and the Republicans get along okay, and what they're doing is just sort of scratching each other's backs to sort of, you know, give each other all sorts of unspeakable sort of privileges and really awful things like this. And it, I don't know. It's all okay, I don't even want to think about
it. So over the weekend, and I tried to unplug as much as I can, which is not really much. I'm not really good at it. I need more practice. Maybe you guys are better at it.
You had good dog picks, Charlie. They were good.
But
dog
that's
picks.
Okay. But you know, that's all I got. You know, is I got the dogs. You have kids and lives and, you know, things like that. I was driving around Wisconsin. We actually went out to some folks' house in some of the most beautiful countryside that we have here in Wisconsin. But in any case, I had a chance to sort of, you know, think through the state of politics unattached to the, you know, intense partisan media scrutiny that we normally give it. And you have to always remember, you know, guys like us have to remind ourselves that there's the it's sort of the analogy that I'm searching for here is the iceberg, which is the cliche, which is that, you know, we know all the stuff that's below the waterline, but the vast majority of voters only look at the stuff, the issues that are above the waterline. And so not everything, you know, will register with them. I think a lot of the Trump tweets are going to be below the waterline for a lot of folks. If the Democrats come out in favor of something that looks like gun confiscation, for school busing, taking away private insurance, open borders, things like that, trust me, that's going to be above the line sort of stuff. You know, there are a lot of folks in Wisconsin who maybe absolutely detest everything about Donald Trump, but they are not going to vote to have the government take away their health insurance or take away their guns or any of these other stuff. That will register with them. But the point that I was going to get at here is the Jeffrey Epstein stuff is going to break through outside of the normal political media bubble because it's so sensational and because there's something in it for everyone. I mean, it's got your money. It's got your intrigue. It is a miniseries. This is a freaking miniseries. It's got your sex. It's got your underage girls. It's got your, you know, prominent, powerful men, including presidents of the United States. I mean, is there anything this story doesn't have other than nuclear weapons and flying dragons? Flying dragons.
Oh, we had to throw in a Game of Thrones reference because this is the Bulwark podcast. But if our left-right politics are trench warfare from World War I in, you know, your team blue or your team red, this is the sweet meteor of death, and it's going to just destroy everything. And then, you know, maybe the cockroaches on the MAGA right who survived the sweet meteor of death are going to be like, see, Trump was right about influence and power, even though he knows the guy and is friends with the guy. And I think that's probably where the right is going to go with this. The left had to deal with Harvey Weinstein and their donations and whatnot, and Epstein being a liberal. This won't be their first go around, whereas the right basically is stuck with Steve Wynn, and they've stuck with all these other creepy donors.
Think about this. This is a massive sex scandal. Obviously, now that you've said that, we know it's going to be another one of these disappointments where nothing matters. We're going to look back on this and remember, we actually did a podcast where he said this was going to be a big deal. It turned out to be absolutely nothing. But the thing about it, the other sort of sweet thing about this is it's Clinton and Trump all over again. It's like we're caught in this time warp, right? Everything is going to be Clinton and Trump. So we are stocked with whataboutism. So
it'll be the whataboutism trench wars.
Yeah,
one bad action cancels out the other one.
Yeah.
See,
Donald Trump did 13-year-old girls. Well, Bill Clinton did 3 14-year-old girls, and it'll be just back and forth. But it is this: how did we get in? You know, Andrew, how did we fall into this wormhole where we're constantly dealing with Clinton Trump, and it's like we're just like, you know, like snakes and scorpions tied up in a bag or something.
I
you know what I'm saying?
How did that happen? I don't know. I don't know what exactly went wrong. Other than, you know, just takesters like us, just all the time doing the partisan squabbling thing. I don't know, but it's, I mean, am I crazy to sort of hope that this isn't going to be like that? I mean, I don't know. I mean, you got people like Nancy Pelosi's daughter, Christine Pelosi. I don't know if you guys saw her tweet from a couple days ago where she said, this Epstein case is horrific and the young women deserve justice. It is quite likely that some of our faves are implicated, but we must follow the facts and let the chips fall where they may, whether on Republicans or Democrats. I mean, yeah, I mean, like, it seems like, you know, maybe this is like too starry-eyed and naive, but it does seem like something this horrific, something this clearly wrong and just gross on every level, from the sex stuff and the abuse stuff to just the fact that it's, you know, the incredibly, incredibly rich sort of doing these things without any sort of accountability until now. If there were anything that, like, sort of people could rally around, just sort of exerting this, allowing this to sort of transcend the partisan squabbling, to be like, yeah, if you were on this, if you were on this plane participating in this stuff, you're done. It doesn't matter. We're not going to rally around you. If anything would work, you'd think this story would be something that could shake us loose a little bit. So we'll see. I mean, I don't know.
The playbook's already been written. You saw how the Pennsylvania report was responded to by, like, the Catholic League. How the Catholic Church dealt with this stuff. And as a Catholic, as Charlie is, I mean, our church has committed some real sins. And they covered it up, and people still aren't over it. But you saw how they did it, and our parties are going to do this. And I'm not going to say law, nothing matters. It will matter. But I think that the thing I'm not looking forward to at all is seeing how partisans on either side are going to try and, you know, turn this into a win for Team Blue or Team Red. We're talking about adolescents here, children, and this is horrific stuff. And they're going to literally start trying to explain away or make it comparatively less bad. And that, you know, that's going to kill me. I mean, not literally, but like it's just, you know, going to execute my soul.
That actually might flip some people one way or another.
Just I hope.
At a discuss for all of this. So going back to the how everything comes back to politics and that we have no zone in our life that is not soiled by politics, which I think was
women's
kind
soccer.
That's exactly where I was going. See, we've been doing this so long that we actually
mind
know
melt.
Each other's segues. Yes, women's soccer. This was just a fabulous win. These are extraordinary women under amazing pressure. High school. I'm not a soccer fan, but I have to just say, you know, that in the annals of calling your shot and then delivering it, this is right up there. And of course, now everything is, does this help MAGA or does this not help MAGA? I see your good friend, Jim, your good friend Kurt Schlichter is apparently seriously butthurt about all of this because he tweeted out, garbage person or something about Rapinoe who just basically kicked all of their asses.
And I saw someone like say, Rapinoe, get out of my country. It's like, it's her country too. You know, just because she doesn't want to go to the White House doesn't mean she should
winning,
be deported.
And they made America great again. If there was ever any indication that it's all about Trump, it's like you have an American team that beats the rest of the world, and it's like, yeah, we don't want you because
And did you see the Nike ad, Charlie? Oh my gosh,
Yeah.
Right after they won, they had this kind of inspiring Nike ad, and it was
amazing.
I didn't even look at Twitter to see the takes, but I can just imagine how bad they were. If you don't like soccer, soccer's not my favorite sport. Soccer's not America's favorite sport. Be proud of your country, even if you don't like the people playing for them. If one of these guys from the Golden State Warriors was playing on Team USA, I hate Golden State. I like basketball. They're representing my country. I want them to win. I want America to win. Who doesn't? And if you don't have anything nice to say, shut the up. Come on. It's performative wokeness. And, these guys are all putting on an act.
Yeah. You can just ignore them, right? I mean, there's no reason. Like, they're just shouting into the ether. They're choosing not to celebrate a very fun and cool thing. We get to call soccer with our heads held high for the next 4 years or how, I don't even know how long. I'm betraying my ignorance. How long is it between World Cups?
This is all old man yells at clouds material.
Yeah, right, right, exactly.
Well, can I also though, just going back to this, the Colin Kaepernick thing, and to peel off another scab. We have a piece at The Bulwark by Robert Trusinski, which is it's really fantastic. The Saving Principles, Colin Kaepernick versus Frederick Douglass. I mean, and Kaepernick put out a tweet where he very selectively quotes Frederick Douglass to make it sound like Frederick Douglass really hated Independence Day and regarded America as irredeemably sinful. And Trusinski goes back and says, let's look at what Frederick Douglass actually said in context with a little bit of history. And it really is, it's a breath of fresh air to put this in context. But I mean, I'm sorry, I don't want to engage in this kind of rhetoric. There are people who cannot help the fact that cannot conceal the fact that they kind of just do despise America, that they think that America has never redeemed itself, should never be celebrated, that there is something just sort of, irredeemably tainted about America. That was not Frederick Douglass's point of view, but it clearly is Colin Kaepernick. And why the left continues to take him seriously, or embrace him, I was going to say is mysterious, but maybe it's not at all.
He triggers conservatives. It's
I'm
the
triggered.
Same, it's,
I'm thoroughly
it's the
triggered.
Same, it's the same reason the right embraces stupid people that trigger the left. Enemy, my enemy is my friend. Who cares about principle? Who cares about thoughtfulness? Doesn't matter. Does it make my enemies angry? Yes, cool. Therefore, must be good.
Well, and Charlie, to the point you were just making, I think that part of that the fervor with which a lot of people apply a particular standard to America, which it then doesn't live up to, and so then America stands condemned. That has to have something to do with the way that politics has sort of like increasingly replaced religion as sort of the central, most sort of meaningful thing for a lot of people's lives, right? I mean, the way that we now sort of hold up the state, hold up our country, hold up our political leaders as sort of the great heroes and the great sort of individual actors of our sort of national narrative, and the sort of the standards are not just sort of the standards of people coming together and like just sort of trying to do as best they can sort of politically to not kill each other and not steal and pillage and rampage and just sort of like try to get along best they can as sort of like human beings around here. But it's this sort of almost religious sense of needing to sort of transcend as a nation, as a state.
Well,
sort of all of us together politically.
You're right about that. And I was going back and I did for my deep thoughts on my newsletter, did Brett Stevens' column about Robespierre's America. And of course, the French Revolution would be the perfect example of when religion was replaced by fierce ideology. in which people were just, you know, any distinction between their own political adversaries and the people's enemies were obliterated. And this whole sort of, you know, new climate that we're in. This, by the way, is a really interesting column that Bret Stephens wrote, talking about the difference between Thomas Jefferson's America and Robespierre's America. I would strongly urge people to read that as well. By the way, if you guys think you get beat up on Twitter a lot, whoa.
Oh, man. Bret Stephens, man.
He's a glutton for punishment.
Okay, now did I miss something over the weekend while I was actually trying to enjoy life? Is there now a big debate about whether air conditioning is good or bad?
Oh, we don't need to get into that, right? The further north you are, so I'm in northern Michigan right now. Air conditioning, who needs it? Take it or leave it.
Yeah, I didn't have air conditioning until I was out of college at my childhood home, but that was in Ohio. I think you do need it in places like St. Louis or places like Washington, D.C. And the Germans.
Birmingham, Alabama.
People are dying in Germany, and Germans are like, oh, yes, you Americans are so weak. And, you know, like, well, you know, obviously, if you die, you just. And then I was at German grocer Aldi, and they're selling air conditioners for $100 for window units. I guess Germany didn't need them, so they can offer them to us at a discount.
Well, I will say that over the weekend, I actually installed 2 window air conditioning units at my cottage. So I'm on team air conditioning here. Part of it was when I grew up, I used to have really bad allergies. I used to have hay fever. And so during the summer, I had to be in air conditioned rooms. That it miraculously went away. I turned 40 and it just went away. It changed my life completely. But, you know, these debates are silly, except in the back of my mind, I'm always thinking, you know what? Nobody ever can have an opinion about something without having to have an action item. And at some point, those folks are going to try to take away air conditioning from us, and that's just not going to happen.
Germany shouldn't have gotten rid of nuclear, gone entirely renewable. I mean, obviously, air conditioning requires a lot of power, but you should have kept those nuclear power plants open and just embraced air conditioning like the rest of the modern world.
Look, I don't want to pick on the Germans here. I do not want to go into this, but perhaps if the Germans had more air conditioning, they would have been, I don't know, a little less cranky over the last century. You know what I'm saying? Gentlemen, thank you so much for helping to initiate another week after the long weekend. So we've blown the cobwebs off from 4 days of actually living life as opposed to being caught up in the partisan spiral. So I appreciate it very much. Andrew Egger and Jim Swift.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
All limbered up and ready to do the news.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.